With Passport and Parasol, seven true stories of travel and adventure, written and compiled by Julia Kay.
On the fringe of the vast island continent of Australia live a few million white people. In the vast desert regions far from the coast live a few thousand black people, the remnants of the first inhabitants of Australia. The race on the fringe of the continent has been there about 100 years and stands for civilization. The race in the interior has been there no man knows how long and stands for barbarism. Between them, a woman has lived in a little white tent for more than 40 years, watching over these people for the sake of the flag. A woman alone, the solitary spectator of a vanishing race.
Scarcely a Sacrifice, the story of Daisy Bates, with Sinead Cusack as Daisy and Edward D'Souza as the narrator.
400 miles out from Port Augusta, the train stops at Uldia. There is no station, just a siding where east and westbound trains of the Trans-Australian Railway can pass on the otherwise single track. But many a passenger on those early trains must have blinked twice at the sight that met his eyes at Uldia. Immaculately dressed in a long-sleeved white blouse with a stiff collar, ankle-length skirt and high-heeled button boots, a little old lady waited in the blazing midday sun while the guard sorted out her mail. Dismissing this improbable sight as a phantom of the heat shimmer, the passengers drifted back to sleep and the train drew out. But the lady was no mirage. She was Daisy Bates, Justice of the Peace and Honorary Protector of the Aborigines of Western and South Australia.
When I first came to Uldia, I made my camp near the track. But being in full view of the trains, this was scarcely the place to accomplish my work for the natives. And it was not long before I transferred my camp to a sandy gully a mile north. There was an 8-foot by 10-foot tent for my living and sleeping, and an upturned tank which I utilized as a library, storing there my manuscripts and books. A shed made of boughs that held everything from my daily provender and supplies for the natives to their most sacred totem boards, and a smaller shed on the crest of a little hill with a ladder leading to its leafy roof, which was my observatory. But my life's work began in June 1900. I was invited by my old friend Dean Martelli to meet Bishop Gibney, Roman Catholic Bishop of the State of Western Australia. The bishop and the dean were about to pay a visit to the Trappist mission at Beagle Bay. I was invited to go with them and see this mission for myself and to tell of its benefits or otherwise to the native. I accepted with alacrity and made my preparation for the journey.
Daisy Bates was 39 years old. Her father, a member of the Irish landed gentry from County Tipperary, had died when Daisy was 20, leaving her a small inheritance, on the strength of which she had travelled to Australia to visit family friends. Carried away by the adventure, Daisy had then made what she afterwards referred to as the one great mistake of her life. But by 1900, her marriage to Jack Bates, an impecunious stockman with whom she'd rapidly discovered she had nothing in common, was long over. Their son, now 14 years old, was living with his paternal grandparents in Perth. Daisy was free to go her own way.
I was told that the fate of the Beagle Bay mission hung on the report of the government valuator. He would be coming hard on our heels to make a patrol to see if the necessary improvements had been carried out. If the sum of these improvements did not total £5,000, the government grant must be forfeited. By the end of July, the two priests and I were underway.
Beagle Bay is remote, even by Australian standards. The first stage of the journey involved a sea voyage of over 1,000 miles northwards, round the coast from Perth. At the little port of Broome, the two elderly Catholic priests and the sprightly Irish lady transferred to an ancient pearling boat for the second stage. 3 days in this rickety and malodorous vessel took them to the shores of the bay.
When we arrived at the mission, We were met by three Trappist monks who ran it. From them, I learned that not only was there no accommodation for a woman at the monastery, but according to Trappist rules, no woman except a queen could be allowed within its walls. However, there I was, and the dear little acting abbot took it upon himself to grant me a dispensation.
Neither the invitation nor the dispensation were given casually. The aim of the mission was to bring civilization and Christianity to the aboriginal tribes who were being drawn from the interior by the novelties of the coastal pearling stations. In the years since the breakdown of her marriage, Daisy had established herself as a respected journalist and had frequently spoken out on behalf of Australia's beleaguered Aborigines. Her support would greatly enhance the Trappists' claim for continued government funding for their work. The mission had been in existence for 10 years. For the monks, those 10 years had been one long struggle against the elements as cyclones, sandstorms and bushfires repeatedly demolished their buildings, ruined their crops and killed their animals. They needed all the help they could get if their mission was to survive. Every pair of hands was welcome, even if they belonged to a woman.
When I arrived, the mission was but a collection of tumble-down paper-bark monastery cells, a little bark chapel and a community room made of corrugated iron. There were four monks left on the station, one of whom, little Frère Jean, had been dedicated to the service of God in France in his early childhood. I was the first white woman, other than his mother, he had seen or looked at in his life. As I came into the community room, Frère Jean fled, crossing himself desperately against the world, the flesh and the devil that I represented. But before I left Beagle Bay, he had so far overcome his religious horror of me that he made and fitted me with a neat little pair of kangaroo skin shoes and even slept trustfully in my company when we all camped out on our survey expedition. Perhaps the first woman in history to sleep in a Trappist bed, I was allotted the abbot's bag bed and seaweed pillow and a sawn-off log for my chair or table. I woke to hear the natives singing a Gregorian chant in the tiny chapel nearby.
It took the Trappists a little time to get used to having a white woman living in their midst, but Daisy's brisk, common-sense attitude soon convinced them that her presence constituted no threat to their immortal souls. She was a novelty, too, to the Aborigines in the surrounding camp, none of whom had ever set eyes on a white woman before.
When I rose, I found myself surrounded by about 30 naked women of all sizes, giggling at me. Being quite unsophisticated, they were as much amused by my appearance as I by theirs. I have always observed a scrupulous neatness in my dress, but I think I never made a more laughable toilet than that one. Every motion of mine, as I laced my corsets and eased my shoes on with a shoehorn, brushed my hair and adjusted my collar and waist belt, was greeted with long-drawn squeals of laughter and mirrored in action, though the slim black daughters of Eve about me had not even a strand of ribbon between the whole 30.
The promise of reward produced volunteers from amongst the Aborigines to help with the restoration of the mission. But, as Daisy discovered, it was one thing to get them there, quite another to get them to do anything.
The 4 months that I spent there was nothing but the sheerest hard work. I was set in charge of some native women to do the scrubbing, that is, the hoeing up of the small shoots or saplings of uprooted trees, and to open up the fallen wells. I worked like a Trojan, but the force of my example failed dismally. Day after day, those women played with the babies and laughed both with me and at me, full of merriment and good feeling. I tried to gather the babies and the children and play with them to let their mothers do a little manual labor, and I started ring-a-ring roses. But no sooner had we got into the swing of the game than every woman and girl downed tools to join in. I compromised. We adults must work, and when the rest time came at hot midday or evening, we would have games. The little plan was a success, and so we worked and played merrily throughout. And as we did, they talked to me and told me a little of their laws.
Although Daisy admired the practical work of the missionaries, she had less sympathy with their spiritual mission. An Anglican herself, She felt strongly that the proselytization hindered rather than advanced the Aborigines' attempts to come to terms with white culture. But she remained tactfully silent on this score, except when her sense of humor got the better of her.
Knowing that he would probably never again pay another visit to the mission, the bishop announced his intention of baptizing all the natives in the district, and I shall never forget the occasion. Crowded into the little bark chapel and smelling to high heaven, 65 wild men and women and babies, some wearing nothing but a vest or a handkerchief or a fraction of a pair of trousers, stood before a prelate of the Roman Church in all his ceremonial robes of lace and purple, to be anointed with the holy oils and receive the papal blessing and the little blow on the cheek of Pax Tecum. That afternoon, hearing a succession of loud shrieks of laughter from the camp, I went along to see how the newly confirmed Christians were doing. Imagine my horror and delight to find Goodowell, one of the comedians of the camp, sitting on a tree trunk with a red paint tin on his head. In front of him pranced every member of the tribe, and as they passed Goodowell, each one received a resounding smack under the ear and a shout of, "Bag Tecum." Hilarious and ear-piercing shrieks of laughter followed each smack. I went back in glee to tell the bishop. He shook his head. "Ah, the poor craters," was all he said.
For 4 months, the motley crew at the mission labored desperately to make the necessary improvements. Daisy found herself helping to dig wells, erect fences, dandle babies, and propagate tomato plants. The final task was to survey the entire 10,000 acres covered by the lease, a grueling labor that took them nearly 2 weeks to complete.
Our only surveying instrument were the compass of an old lugger and a chain. The bishop and I were the chain men, and we walked in a steamy heat of 106 degrees, sometimes 12 miles in a day, over marsh and through scrub, now lame from the stones and prickles, now up to our thighs in bog, we plodded on. The bishop in the lead, throwing down a small peg to mark the chain limit, the brothers and the blacks and I behind. I was always in difficulty, owing to my small stride and high-heeled footwear. And many a time, seeing me perched perilously on the edge of a bog, the bishop would give a mischievous twitch to his end of the chain and land me deep in it. The valuator arrived just as we rounded the last corner. He was surprised to see a thriving property where he had expected to see ruin and decay. Every screw and post, every animal and every plant was meticulously valued, and the sum reached was over £6,000. The mission was saved for the natives. Altogether, and in much jubilation, we made the first bricks of sand and loam and clay for the new convent and monastery, of which I laid the foundation brick.
Delighted with their success, the bishop and the dean packed up for their return to Perth. But Daisy had made a decision. She was not going back. The glimpses she had been given into the hidden, private lives of the Aborigines had so intrigued her, their behavior and their customs so filled her with curiosity, that she'd decided to stay with them. For the next 8 months, she made her home among the Coolaraburu tribes of the far northwest. And it was here that she launched into the systematic study of Aboriginal beliefs and customs that would occupy her for the rest of her life.
Riding and roaming in the scrubland, always accompanied by the boys and women of the nearby station and any nomad visitors that came along, I would camp out, sometimes for days, sharing my food, nursing the babies, gathering vegetable food with the women, and making friends with the old men. Thus, I extended and verified my knowledge by gradual degrees, until I gained a unique insight into the whole northern Aboriginal social system and its life story from babyhood to age. Every moment of my spare time was given to this self-imposed and fascinating study.
Daisy herself always attributed her almost uncanny affinity with the Aborigines to her own Irish childhood. Since the death of her mother when she was a baby, she'd been left in the care of an illiterate and very superstitious nurse who had brought her up in an enchanted world of leprechauns and little people. It seemed but a short step from there to the spirit world of the Aborigines.
I realize that to glean anything of value, I must think with their mentality and talk in their language. The natives I found at first amused, and then stimulated to further confidence by my obviously eager and sustained interest. I pretended that my native home was Kalawa, and that I was a magic woman who'd been one of the 22 wives of Liber, a patriarchal or dreamtime father. After that, the way was clear. They accepted me as a kindred spirit, their dreamtime grandmother. By the wells and the creeks, sitting in the camps in the firelight, on horseback and on foot, my notebook and pencil were always with me. I began compiling a dictionary of several dialects and 2,000 words and sentences with notes of innumerable legends and myths. Once I had begun to understand their language and beliefs, the lives of the natives soon became easier to understand, and the poetry of their ceremonies and legends and rituals an enchanting study. At the men's hidden corroborees in the heart of the bush, because I showed no timidity or levity, and because I was thinking with a black man's mind, I have never been a stranger. The men would gather round me, taking infinite pains to tutor me in the rippling inflections and the difficult double vowels of their language, a series of vocal gymnastics quite impossible to the average white linguist, and which, I am perfectly sure, in all my years of juggling with them, have altered the formation of my larynx forever.
The more she learnt of their customs and traditions, the more she appreciated the tragedy that was overwhelming them. The white man's invasion had crashed through their gentle, dreaming world, shattering the centuries-old structure of their lives and undermining their beliefs. They were left wandering like ghosts in a sandy limbo, unable to cling to the past or come to terms with the future. But Daisy, a committed imperialist, never blamed the white man for taking over, just for not understanding the devastating effect of his ways.
The pioneers of Western Australia were noble men and women, and nearly all of them were above reproach, and more than kindly in their treatment of the Aboriginal. But it was a kindness that killed, as surely and as swiftly as cruelty would have done. The Australian native can withstand all the reverses of nature, fiendish droughts and sweeping floods, horrors of thirst and enforced starvation, but he cannot withstand civilization.
She followed her 8-month sojourn in the northwest with 2 years among the remnants of the Bibulmun tribes of the southwest. Travelling sometimes by train, but mostly by horse-drawn buggy, she roamed the coastal plains around Perth and the uplands of the Darling Ranges. But nothing she saw made her any more optimistic about the future of the people who had adopted her as one of themselves.
Who shall say what vague despair and unrest entered those primitive minds as the natives beheld one after another of their cherished homing spots ruthlessly swept away in the resistless march of civilization, and the winding tracks to their various food grounds obliterated by houses and streets. They die in their numbers of the white man's diseases, measles, whooping cough, influenza, and the results of their own wrongdoing.
The Registrar General of Western Australia had been planning for some time to compile an official record of the customs and dialects of the Aborigines. But he needed someone with time, energy, and knowledge to undertake the work. When Daisy returned to Perth in 1904, her reputation as an authority firmly established, she applied for the job and was instantly accepted. She would look back on the next 6 years as among the happiest of her life. The Department of Aboriginal Affairs acknowledged her expertise, and she had government backing for her research. Scientific societies invited her to lecture, their journals published her articles, and ethnologists and anthropologists sought her opinion. By 1910, she had compiled an 800-page treatise, and on the strength of this, she was appointed a Fellow of the Anthropological Society of Australia, Honorary Correspondent of the Royal Anthropological Society of Great Britain and Ireland, and a member of the Royal Geographical Society of Melbourne. But she did not consider her task to be complete.
In 1910, an international expedition arrived in Perth to undertake fieldwork among the West Australian Aborigines. It was a Cambridge University expedition consisting of Professor Radcliffe Brown and Mr. Grant Watson. it was suggested that I accompany the expedition, and with the Colonial Secretary's consent, I was appointed a travelling protector with a special commission to conduct inquiries into all native conditions and problems, and many matters affecting their welfare.
Official policy was geared towards the rapid and total integration of the Aborigines with the white community. In order to survive, the Aborigines must adopt the white man's laws and religion, his morals and his medicine.
The government's medical policy of safeguarding the Aborigines by isolating them for treatment was the unhappiest decision ever arrived at by a humane administration. They want nothing in the world but their own shelters, their old sandbeds and little fires, the smell of their own home area, every secret familiar to them, and the voices of their own kind. There is nothing you can give them but their freedom and their own fires.
But Professor Radcliffe Brown decided that this isolation policy would be an ideal area for his studies. Bracing herself for the horrors she knew were in store, and fortified by the hope that she might be able to comfort her old friends in their misery, Daisy agreed to go with him. The expedition packed up and followed the stricken natives to two islands off the coast of Carnarvon.
Dor and Bernier Islands. There is not in all my sad sojourn among the last sad people of the primitive Australian race a memory one half so tragic or harrowing, or a name that conjures up such a deplorable picture of misery and horror unalleviated as these two grim and barren islands off the West Australian coast. When I landed on Bernier Island in November 1910, there were only 15 men left alive there, but I counted 38 graves. On Dor, where the women were segregated, there were 77 women, many of them bedridden. I dared not count the graves. Most of them were in the last stages of venereal disease and tuberculosis. Nothing could save them. Yet they had been transported, some of them thousands of miles, to strange and unnatural surroundings. They were afraid of the hospital, its ceaseless probings and dressings, and injections were a daily torture. They were afraid of each other. They were afraid of the ever-moaning sea. Through unaccustomed hot baths, their withered, sensitive skins, which are never cleansed in their natural state, save by grease and fresh air, became like tissue paper and parted horribly from the flesh. Some of them cried all day and all night in a listless and terrible monotony of grief. There was no ray of brightness, no gleam of hope.
The expedition remained on the islands for 6 months, studying the effects of various forms of treatment on the natives. Daisy stayed too, dividing her time between her official duties and caring for the people she now regarded as her children. The experience on those dreadful islands would haunt her for the rest of her life.
I did what I could amongst them with little errands of mercy, distributing rations and blankets, bringing sweets and dainties for young and old, extra blankets in the rain, and where I could, a word of love and understanding. To the grey-headed and the grey-bearded men, women and children alike, I had been known for many years as Kalawa, a grandmother, but a spurious and very young one. Here in Dor, I became Kabali, grandmother to the sick and dying, and Kabali I was to remain in my wanderings.
In the middle of 1911, the expedition was wound up. Daisy returned to Perth and delivered her completed manuscript, the fruit of 8 years of intensive study, to the Registrar General, Malcolm Fraser. Fraser was so impressed with it that on his suggestion, the manuscript was forwarded to a distinguished anthropologist in London, who agreed to revise it for publication in book form. But although she was delighted with the idea of a book, by now, Daisy had more important things on her mind. A vacancy had occurred in the Department of Aboriginal Affairs for a Chief Protector of Aborigines for the whole of the Northern Territories. Daisy decided to apply for the job, but she did not get it. The official reason given was that as a woman, she would be subjected to too many risks and would need a police escort to travel amongst the Aborigines. To one who had lived alone and unprotected amongst the Aborigines for years at a time without coming to the slightest harm, this explanation sounded hollow indeed. Daisy believed the real reason was that the department had taken exception to her outspoken criticisms of its working methods. With this rejection, another strand in her link with officialdom had snapped. With as much grace as she could muster, she accepted the department's alternative suggestion that she should go, as honorary protector, and therefore unpaid, to the Eucla district. She arrived at Eucla in November 1912, determined that from now on she would work for and with the Aborigines on her own terms.
Eucla is nowadays nothing but a name on a map, 8 miles west of the South Australian border, a street of ruined houses almost completely engulfed in the sand, just at the point where the majestic cliffs of the Great Australian Bight recede inland to form the western edge of the vast Nullarbor Plain. I pitched my tent 2 miles from the settlement near the beach. From a hollow in sandhills, I could look out upon the great sweeping billows of the Southern Ocean rolling in thunder, sometimes a single wave 2 miles long. By this time, I was a confirmed wanderer, a nomad even as the Aborigines. So close had I been in contact with them that it was now impossible for me to relinquish the work. I realized that they were passing from us, and I must make their passing easier. Moreover, all that I knew was so little in comparison with all there was yet to learn. I made the decision to dedicate the rest of my life to this fascinating study. I admit that it was scarcely a sacrifice. Apart from the joy of the work for its own sake, the freshness, the freedom, the farness meant much more to me now than the life of the cities.
Daisy stayed at Eucla for 2 years. Her little tent became a beacon to the wandering groups of Aborigines, melancholy and bewildered, who had been uprooted from their traditional lands by the remorseless march of the white man's progress. From north and west, from the coastal plains and the far hills, they drifted in to sit with Kabali, their dreamtime grandmother, to talk of times gone by, to tell their stories, act out rituals, and, as Daisy saw it, to wait for death. Every day she wrote up her notes. Every story she was told, every new dialect she heard spoken, every scrap of new information was meticulously written down. She corresponded, too, with her friends from the scientific and anthropological worlds, many of whom expressed their dismay that she should bury herself in the back of beyond and begged her to return to civilization. For 2 years, she resisted their pleas, but in 1914 came an invitation she could not bear to turn down. She was invited to Adelaide to address the Congress of the British Association for the Advancement of Science.
How vivid was the green beauty of the Adelaide Hills as I entered the bay, after so long lost among the sand. Members of the Congress, leading men of their day from the leading universities of the world, were due to arrive, and I was busy with the compilation of my notes and deep in the joys of anticipation, when one day as I walked along King William Street, my attention was struck by the newspapers announcing the declaration of war. England and Germany, Russia, France and Belgium, the whole world in turmoil. My own thought had been so remote from international concerns for so long that I stood aghast.
The war gave the Australians something new to worry about. Their sons were fighting and dying on the other side of the world, and in the face of that horror, even the staunchest of her supporters found it hard to concentrate on the fate of the Aborigines. Daisy returned to Eucla and stayed there for the duration of the war, but by then, word had reached her of the impact on the tribes of the west and north of the new transcontinental railway. Bidding farewell to her friends, the 58-year-old lady packed up her camp and set off to see for herself.
When I came to Uldia Siding in September 1919, I found conditions difficult. Some hundreds of derelict natives had established their camps at the sidings and travelled up and down the line, begging from the train at every stopping place, a responsibility and a menace, in that many of them were already ravaged by disease. The newly formed railway settlements had not yet recovered from the chaos of the very recent construction. Aftermath of war was still in the air, and the unrest among the white communities was almost as distressing as the obvious degeneration of the black. Prostitution of native women was rife, sought by the blacks and encouraged by the lowest whites, and many unfortunates had already reaped the wages of sin. When the first half-caste babies appeared, the wild mothers believed that they were the result of eating the white man's food and rubbed them frantically with charcoal to restore their black health and colour, till often they died.
At Uldia, she came across several individuals she had met before in her earlier, happier travels. Young and old, sick, blind and in despair, they fell on their beloved Kabali with cries of joy and begged her to stay with them. Thus it was that Daisy Bates pitched the tent and set up the camp that was to be her home for the next 16 years.
The first years at Uldia were years of unceasing work. The endeavour to reconcile the old conditions with the new was pathetic. My first task, as the group stepped over the threshold of civilization, was to set them at ease and clothe them, learn their names and their homes, explain the white man's laws, and tell them of the resources and the dangers of this new age they had stumbled into. Outside my little tent, the natives would come to await my attention, old friends sitting patiently, and naked newcomers shyly flitting among the scrub, sometimes 2 days before they summon courage to approach this Kabali of whom they had heard so far away. They came to me from the Man, the Goss, the Everard, the Peterman and the Musgrave Ranges, occasionally from as far away as Tanami, from Kalgoorlie and Laverton in the west and Streaky Bay in the east, and from across the northwestern borders of the state. Sometimes 2 years on the journey, zigzagging in the desert for food and water, they followed the tracks of those who had come in before them, disintegrating, reuniting, mourning and rejoicing, and every moon fleeing further from their hereditary waters. At last, the remnants arrived on the rim of civilization outside my windbreak. All along the 1,000 miles of the railway, there was no other sanctuary, no halfway house between the white man's traffic and the native intelligence 5,000 years behind. It was impossible to leave these people. So savage and simple were they, so much astray, and so utterly helpless, that somehow they became my responsibility.
Daisy's many friends in the worlds of anthropology and journalism took up her cause, pleading for government funding for her work and putting her name forward every time a post of protector of Aborigines fell vacant. But the Department of Aboriginal Affairs never forgave her for her public denunciation of their policies. Not only did they refuse to consider her for the job of official protector, but not once, during all the 16 years she was at Uldia, did they grant her any funds towards her work.
My own fare, day after day throughout the years, has always been so simple that to myself I am a miracle. I have always consoled myself with the reflection that the simpler our needs, the nearer we are to the gods. A potato in the ashes, now and again a spoonful of rice, that 9 times out of 10 was burned in my absence, or absent-mindedness. Occasionally the treat of a boiled egg, and always tea, my panacea for all ills. These were the full extent of my culinary craft.
Nor did she consider near penury any excuse for lowering her personal standards.
I invariably rose at sunrise, when the days are at their most glorious, and made my toilet to a chorus of impatient twitterings from my friends the birds. It was a fastidious toilet, for throughout my life I have adhered to the simple but exact dictates of fashion as I left it when Victoria was queen. A neat white long-sleeved blouse, stiff collar and ribbon tie, a dark ankle-length skirt and coat, stout and serviceable trim shoes and neat black stockings, a sailor hat and fly veil, and for my excursion to the camps, always a dust coat, sunshade and gloves. Not until I was in meticulous order would I emerge from my tent, dressed for the day.
In 1922, she caught an eye infection from one of her patients and for 3 weeks thought she was going blind. The 1,000-mile trip she made to Perth to visit an oculist was her only holiday from the Nullarbor plane in nearly 2 decades. In 1928, by which time Daisy was 68 years old, the careless overexploitation of the natural underground reservoir by the railway company resulted in every waterhole in the area becoming brackish and polluted. Now she had to walk 2 miles to the line and back, carrying all her water in buckets attached to a yoke across her shoulders. To make her already grueling existence even more of a trial, this man-made disaster coincided with a natural one.
The failure of the water supply coincided with an 8-year drought, perhaps the worst in South Australian history. Year after year, little or no rain fell upon the parched earth. Native foods dwindled and vanished, fruit and root and berry. Raging winds scoured the plain. Summer temperatures soared to 120 in the shade for weeks, even months, culminating occasionally in a shade record of 126 degrees. Sandstorms raged for hours at a time, and when the heaviest gusts threatened to rob me of house and home, I clung frantically to the ridgepole of my tent, pitting my slender weight against the strength of the elements, and when they abated, crept in exhausted, to find my bed, my table, my typewriter, and everything else within covered with nearly a foot of sand. These were years of so much increasing difficulty and disheartenment that had it not been for the guiding light of my ideals of service and my deep love and sympathy for the natives, I could never have lived them through.
Her disheartenment was not the result of the drought. Band after band of Aborigines moved into her camp, only to drift on again, the superficial attractions of white civilization undermining all her efforts to save them from its remorseless pull. But she stuck doggedly to her guns. The Aborigines were doomed. There was nothing she or anyone else could do to save them from extinction. But she could help them to prepare for their fate with dignity and integrity.
As each group came and went, it left me the legacy of its derelicts. My work, as always, was confined to attendance on the sick and feeble, the very old and the very young. For the full-grown healthy males, I had neither rations nor blankets. I encouraged their hunting crafts and the subsistence of their own foods. My success throughout the camps in tending them in sickness was that I never attempted to alter their natural habits and environment. White medicines are not in harmony with the native constitution, and the white man's hospital only aggravates their sickness. Keeping them in their own little bush shelters under the branches they loved, with their own people about them, I tended them with grandmotherly cough mixtures, massaging with oils, nourishing foods, and much cheeriness.
In 1932, when Daisy was 72 years old, she received a visit that would turn her into a celebrity. An internationally successful Australian journalist had heard about this eccentric old lady who had chosen to live among the Aborigines and decided to come to Uldia to see if the stories were true. The resulting articles were widely syndicated, and soon all Australia was talking about the charming little lady of the old school, daughter of the sporting gentry of Ireland, who was accepted as a tribeswoman and guardian spirit of the most occult race in the world. But fame hardly brought fortune.
I had subsisted for a month on porridge, warm in the morning and made into a damper cake for my supper, when two unexpected checks endowed me with sudden wealth. One was for the amount of £7.10 from an American university for a detailed survey of the sex life of the Australian Aborigine. The other, from the University of Adelaide, for a series of anthropological notes compiled, was a generous grant of £60. I immediately allotted £40 of this to the replenishing of the native food supplies and devoted the other £20 to recuperating my own health, with a series of nourishing, well-cooked meals purchased from the dining saloon of the passenger expresses passing 4 days weekly. I enjoyed these luncheons and dinners with the appetite of a healthy child. I had not realized how hungry I was.
Daisy stayed at Uldia until 1935. Her only break during all that time was a brief visit to Adelaide in 1933 to receive the CBE. During this trip, she enjoyed her first proper bath for 12 years and remarked sadly that the passing years had turned her into something of an anachronism. Not until she was well into her 76th year did one of her old friends manage to persuade her that it was time to leave her wilderness camp, and even then he had to resort to gentle subterfuge. Knowing that she'd kept copious notes throughout her long years at Uldia, he suggested that she owed it to her Aboriginal friends to write a book incorporating everything she'd learned about their customs and their way of life. Such a book would ensure that even if they themselves were doomed to die, their story would not. It was a shrewd suggestion, and probably the only way of stopping Daisy from sitting quietly down in the desert in the Aboriginal fashion and waiting for death.
I had thought to spend my last days at Uldia, earning my modest living with my pen, ministering as ever to those who might need me, faithful to the end of my life's loyalties. This was an opportunity, not of renouncing my life's devotion, but of consummating it. My voluminous notes had been scribbled anyhow and everywhere, on white paper and brown, in diaries and notebooks and fragments, illegible and unintelligible to any save me, packed into any receptacle that would hold them in my 8x10 tent, where they became inextricably mixed and were in constant peril of destruction. Now and again I had taken a bulging bundle, trying to reduce it to lucidity, but the hot winds and sandstorms and the constant demands upon my time had only made the ethnological confusion worse confounded. I had passed the allotted span of my life by 5 long years. My step was as light and my heart as gay as they had been in youth. But I could no longer shut my eyes to the fact that if I were to accomplish my work for Australia and its lost people, I must lose no time. But the hope was qualified with regret. For now, I must bid farewell to that little tent home, patched with 100 patches, ragged and empty and devoid of comfort, yet so full of loving memories. Kabali must take leave of her grandchildren.
Daisy wrote her book. She also collated and filed her notes and donated them, 94 folios in all, to Australia's National Library. But she could not settle for long in civilization. In 1941, she decided to return to the wilderness, and at the age of 80, she made herself a new camp east of Uldia to live again in the peace and solitude she loved. Daisy Bates, the confirmed wanderer, the nomad who had lived with and for the Aborigines for more than 40 years, died at the age of 90 on the 18th of April, 1951.
Scarcely a Sacrifice, the story of Daisy Bates, was written and compiled by Julia Kay. Sinead Cusack played Daisy, and Edward D'Souza was the narrator. The producer was John Powell.